Well, it's a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Dr. Natan Slifkin back to Torah Moshe. He actually gave a series, I believe in 2013, you know, when Torah Moshe was doing these online classes before anybody heard of COVID or Zoom. It was like a different world, but it's a pleasure to welcome him back. Of course, he is the director of the founder and director of the Biblical Museum of Natural History in Beit Shemesh, where this class is taking place from. He has a doctorate from Bar-Ilan University on the rabbinic encounters on zoology. I'm sure many of you know he's written many, many books on science and animals and many, many things. And he has a very popular, I guess, important blog, I guess that's what we call it, Rational Judaism. I think his latest book is Rationalism and Mysticism. So everybody, welcome. It's a pleasure. It's going to be a six-part series starting with the animals of Perkei Avot, live from the Biblical Museum of Natural History in Beit Shemesh in Israel. Vakasha, Rabbi Doctor, it's all yours.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Kelman. Wonderful to be back with Torah in Motion, even if it's in Israel and not in Africa. But hopefully we'll get the Africa trip going one day.
Right. So I forgot to mention all our African tours. We've had, I think, six of them. So yes, the safaris to Africa. Yes. That's coming up.
Yeah. So this mini series, I planned it so that each of the talks will take place in a different hall of the museum. So today's, which is on the animals of Perkei Avot, is going to take place in our hall of biblical wildlife. So let me just slide the camera into here. All right. Here we go. This is our Hall of Biblical Wildlife. This is where we exhibit all the larger animals that used to live in the land of Israel in biblical times. Right? And today's focus is on the four creatures in particular. Hold on a second, camera's falling. Four creatures in particular. And they are the ones that appear in the Mishnah in Perkei Avot, where it says, Yehuda ben Tema Omer. Yehuda ben Tema says, and he then lists four animals. And we'll start with Gibor Ka'ari. He says that you should be as strong as a lion. Right? And the Mishnah finishes, to do the will of your Father in heaven. Okay, so a religious exhortation to be as strong as a lion. So let's go over to our lion. Oops. Here we go. So here's our lion. Right? His name is Simba. And Simba here was born in Denmark. He made Aliyah when he was 6 months old. He lived in Haifa, in the zoo, of course. And he lived to a very ripe old age. Lions in the wild only live about 11, 12 years. But Simba lived to the ripe old age of 19. Very, very old for a lion. Now, of course, he takes pride of place here at the museum, the lion being the king of beasts. The lion being also mentioned more times in Tanakh, not just more times than any other wild animal, but more times than every other wild animal put together. Now, the lion's mentioned 150 times in Tanakh, and then 200 times in the Gemara. The lion also has several names in Tanakh, right? And that's also attests to its significance. You know how, like, you know, Eskimos have like 100 different words for snow, and people from Manchester have like 20 different words for rain, right? So the fact that the lion has many different names in Tanakh also attests to its significance. Right, and those names include Aryeh, Lavi, Laish, Shachal, Shachatz, Kfir, all different names for the lion. Now, so lions, of course, used to live here, right here in the land of Israel. In fact, I'm speaking to you from a very special location. Right, so the Biblical Museum of Natural History in its new home, we moved here 4 years ago, we're in a very significant location. I don't know how many of you have visited. But if you come from Route 1, the main Jerusalem-Tel Aviv highway to the museum, so you take the Route 38 to Beit Shemesh, and just before you get to the museum, you pass a building of a tremendous historic significance, and that is IKEA. Right, when IKEA was built here, it was like the building of the third base of Mikdash. Such were the celebrations. But that branch of IKEA is called Eshta'ol. Right, IKEA Eshta'ol, because that's the area where that branch of IKEA is built. And that's on the north side of the museum. On the south side of the museum is a kibbutz called Surah. So the museum is located in between Surah and Eshta'ol. And that's a phrase, Bein Surah ve'Eshta'ol, between Surah and Eshta'ol. That's a phrase that appears many times in Tanakh. referring to a location where a certain very famous person was born, lived, died, was buried. Anybody know who that was? You can type it in the chat box. Which very famous biblical figure?
Shimshon.
Shimshon, exactly. Shimshon HaGibor. So that the museum located right here where Shimshon was. And so all these, you know, stories of Shimshon, you know, attacking a lion, killing a lion, sounds like some wild, faraway legend from Africa. No, it was here. It was around these parts, right? There were wild lions in the land of Israel. And they became extinct here about 800 years ago. Okay, they were slightly different from the lions you're familiar with. The lions that lived here were probably Asian lions, not African lions, right? This is an African lion. Lions lived here were Asian lions, slightly smaller. But there were lions here in the land of Israel. Rabbi Kalm, I just want to check. Are people seeing me large screen? Do I need to do anything on my computer?
No. Anybody who wants, they can go on the view and can put it either on gallery or speaker. So I would advise to, for this, put it on speaker. Then you'll fill up the whole screen. You don't have to do anything. But just, if you put it on gallery, then you see everybody's box or whatever, 20 of them. And if you put it on speaker, you see only the person who's speaking. So that's not for you to worry about.
Okay, good. All right, so moving on with the lion. So the lion, as we said, mentioned many times in Tanakh, very significant, and it also symbolizes certain concepts. What character trait does the lion symbolize? So some visitors say courage, and the answer is no, that's in the Wizard of Oz, right? Not in the Torah. In the Torah, the lion symbolizes two concepts. One is gevura, right? Kingship, because it's, you know, the king of beasts, right? The top predator in the land of Israel, and therefore, you know, it became the symbol, the symbol for kingship. Yehuda, Gur Aryeh Yehuda, right? Judah is a young lion. Interestingly, you know, why does it describe Yehuda as a young lion? Why not an adult lion? So one explanation is because Yehuda wasn't the culmination of the kingship. The culmination of the kingship was later with David HaMelech. Yehuda was the young lion, and David became the full king. And of course, the lion then therefore became the symbol of Yerushalayim. And even today, right, the lion is the symbol of Yerushalayim. The Beis HaMikdash is symbolized as being a lion. Beis HaMikdash is called Ariel. Right? Rabbi Kalman, you've got a son called Ariel, don't you? Right, Ariel, right? Lion of God. So the lion has all this symbolism to do with royalty. But another interesting thing about the lion, while we're on lions, is, you know, all the descriptions of lions in Tanakh, which talk about them, you know, attacking and being dangerous, talk about male lions, right? Now, the problem is, as we all know, that's not what happens, right? It's the female lions, the lionesses who do all the hunting. The male lions are just sleeping all the time, and it's the women who do all the work. They go around and they chase down their prey in the savannah. So why, when the Torah speaks about lions hunting, does it always speak about the male lion? So I was confused by this, and this was many years ago. I was working on this topic, and I was trying to understand it, and then I gave up. So I switched Windows on my computer and decided to read the science news, and I saw a science report about a new discovery about lions, which this was amazing. I'm not so mystically inclined, but this was so providential. It really answered this point. It turns out that all the studies about how lions hunt were done in places where it's easy to watch lions hunting. Where is it easy to watch lions hunting? Kenya, right? They're the open reserves of Africa. And in these open reserves, you see lionesses running and chasing down their prey. But then they did new studies with superior technology and tracking devices and so on. And they found out that that's only where lions live in open country. But in closed country, in thickets and forests, then it's a completely different technique of hunting. There it's the male lions who hunt, and they hunt by lying in ambush. See, male lions are much bigger and stronger than lionesses, but they're not as fast. You know, all that strength compromises their speed. So in places where you need to chase down your prey, it's the lionesses that do the hunting. But otherwise, the lion is the hunter, and therefore, and that's what happens in the style of hunting used in forest habitats, where the male lion lies in wait, and then bursts out to catch his prey. Now, what was the land of Israel? So land of Israel now seems to be open areas like the savannas of Kenya. But that's only now. In biblical times, the country was much more heavily forested. So that's why the lion hunting that took place in Israel in biblical times would have been the male lions, surprising their prey from an ambush attack. Okay. Now, we mentioned one of the character traits of the lion is royalty, but there's another character trait of a lion, and that is gevura, strength. Right, and that's the Mishnah that we're quoting in Pirkei Avot, but it says gibor ka'ari, be as strong as a lion. Now, what does that mean? What's the Mishnah telling us? So simply speaking, it's obviously because a lion, is a very, big, strong animal, right? Weighs up to 500 pounds, right at the top of the food chain, right? But the issue is, if it's talking about brute physical strength, so why does the Mishnah say that we should be as powerful as a lion? What does that mean? We should, build our muscles, be physically strong, lift weights. What does it mean? So I'd like to suggest that perhaps it's alluding to a very unusual aspect of lions. Can anyone tell me, what is the term for a group of lions?
Pride.
Pride.
Pride, correct. Right? Different groups of animals have different names, right? You have a murder of crows, a journey of giraffes, right? A pot of whales, a school of fish, and it's a pride of lions, right? Now, what's the technical term for a group of tigers? A disaster, a bloodbath, right? You don't have a group of tigers, they'd kill each other. See, big cats are carnivores. It means they're aggressive by nature, which means they can't even get along well with each other. So in the wild, you'll find that tigers, leopards, jaguars, cheetahs, lynxes, cougars, right? They all live alone. Of all the big cats, it's only the lion which is somehow able to control its aggression and live in groups, right? In large family groups. And together in these large family groups, they hunt down their prey, right? And that's, of course, the famous saying, the family that preys together stays together. Right. So, what does the Mishnah tell us elsewhere? Ezehu gibor, who is powerful? Hakovesh et Yitzro, the one that controls, that subdues his inclination. But that is the real power of the lion. It's not the lion's raw physical strength. It's its ability to overcome that in the presence of other lions, right? It's the internal strength of the lion. But I think it's a beautiful insight in what this Mishnah means when it tells us to be as powerful as a lion. We're going to move on from Simba here. Just while we're talking about lions, I'll just show you another lion that we've got here. This was a very, very, very old lion that someone donated to us. It was stuffed about 100 years ago. Let's see this lion here. And you can see how old it is. I mean, he has a beautiful mane. But if you can see, he was... nowadays, the technique of stuffing is that you take measurements of the animal, then you skin it, you build a plastic or fiberglass form with the exact specifications of the animal, and you glue the fur back on. But decades ago, before plastic was a thing, they used to stuff it with straw. And that's what they did here, some kind of metal and straw framework. But, over time, over the decades, it started sagging. And if you can see his legs there, looks like he's wearing pajamas that are a size too big for him. It really started to droop. And we call him Captain Saggy Pants. That's what a very old lion looks like. But now I want to go on to another animal. Okay, let's go on up here. Okay, let's get the angle right. All right, what do we have behind me? That is a leopard. Leopard, right? Not to be confused with the cheetah. Cheetah's the one down here facing away from us. All right, you can tell them apart quite easily. Right, cheetahs, well, firstly, their face. Cheetahs have these distinctive teardrop markings down their faces. Right, leopards do not. Cheetahs have spots, leopards have blotches. And overall, it's really the significant thing is the shape of the body. Right, cheetahs have a very rangy build, whereas leopards are built much more compactly for strength. Let's get a better angle here. Hold on. It's a good angle for our leopard. There we go. Facing us from up there. Okay, now, we mentioned about how, obviously it's a given that the animals of Tanakh are the animals from the place where Tanakh happens, where Tanakh takes place, right? The land of Israel, the biblical lands. And leopards used to live here in the land of Israel, just like lions. Except whereas lions all died out here about 800 years ago, leopards were here till very recently. Within the last 20 years, there were still wild leopards living in the land of Israel. Right, the last ones were in the Judean desert, the En Gedi. But the very last, the very, very last ones, what happened, there was a problem. They were breaking into En Gedi and stealing people's dogs and cats. And there was an understandable fear that they might steal a child. So the leopards from En Gedi were removed, and those appear to have been the last wild leopards in the land of Israel. But earlier, even not so far back, they were much more common. In the 1960s, 1970s, there were still leopards up in the Galilee. 100 years ago, not far from Beth Shemesh, there were 5 people mauled by a leopard. So it's something that until quite recently was quite widespread in the land of Israel. Okay, the leopard in Hebrew is called a namer. Namer, and the leopard is also mentioned in this Mishnah we've been discussing. The Mishnah says, as kanamer, which means be as bold as a leopard, as brazen as a leopard. So what does that mean? So what's explained is that leopards, you know, are not as big or as strong as a lion or a bear, but pound for pound, right, for their size, they're the most ferocious. They're not intimidated by anything. Now, I once saw an amazing video of baboons. Baboons are very, very powerful animals. And I saw baboons chasing off a cheetah, but then one leopard came, and this one leopard stood down against this entire troop of baboons. So leopards are very, they're not intimidated by anything. And when the Mishnah says, as can our mare, it's telling us likewise, we should not be intimidated by anything, right? When people are, I mean, it's a specific example discussed in the Torah, and the halakha with the Torah talks about people persecuting you, mocking you for doing God's will. You know, I guess a contemporary example would be if you're on like an Ivy League campus, right? Do not be intimidated by those who are mocking or persecuting you. And that's what we're told to learn from a leopard. While we're on leopards, I just want to mention the leopards also feature significantly, well, so do lions, in the book of Daniel. Right? The prophet Daniel has a dream in which he sees different animals, each of which represent the different kingdoms that have oppressed us. And he sees a lion, and that represents Babylon. And then later he sees a leopard, and that represents ancient Greece. Right, and there, it's the idea of the aggression, the speed with which Alexander the Great took over the ancient world. That's something that symbolizes that this ferocity, symbolized by the leopard, this, you know, utterly ferocious, brazen animal. Okay, so we've had the leopard. Now we're going to move on to another animal. Hold on. Just going past our hippopotamus. Okay, so now we're going to go on to the tzvi. What is a tzvi? Can anyone write it in the chat box? What's a tzvi?
Deer. Swift.
Tzvi is a?
Deer.
Deer. Deer. A hirsch. Right? Tzvi is a deer. Wrong. Tzvi is not a deer. How do I know? I know because the Talmud says that the horns of a tzvi are not branched. But the horns of a deer are branched. So right there, Rashi says, you know, I don't know what's going on. Right? A hirsch and a deer, they do have branched horns. So Rashi says it must be that what we call a tzvi is not really the tzvi. So what is really the tzvi? As somebody wrote in the comments, the tzvi is the gazelle. Right? The gazelle is very, very beautiful animal here. Right? Extremely beautiful. I think that's why it appears in Shir HaShirim. It was a symbol of love because it's such a spectacularly beautiful, graceful animal. That is the tzvi. Okay, so then we have a question. Now, if the tzvi is really the gazelle, so why does everyone always identify tzvi as deer? So the answer is we tell our visitors, well, we start with the question and we ask them, when Israelis go to America for the first time, what are Israelis most excited to see in America apart from Target? And the answer is?
Squirrels.
Squirrels. Israelis go nuts about squirrels. Why? So the answer is, they've never seen them before. Right? Different parts of the world have different animals. Right? And the, which is something that by the way, that may seem obvious, but until about 200 years ago, nobody realized this. Now, people figure that whatever animals they see around them are basically the same animals that everyone in the world sees. They knew there was the occasional, you know, very exotic thing that comes from some faraway place. But by and large, they figured that it's the same animal, more or less the same animals everywhere. And it was really only once Australia was discovered, that Australia had, you know, completely different animals across the board, that people became a lot more sensitive to this idea of biogeography. And realized that, wow, all over the world, no, the animals really are different. But the ramifications of that for studying Torah was still not recognized until much later. And even now, many people, you know, don't realize. But it has to be, right? Torah takes place in a particular part of the world, right? So the animals of the Torah are the animals of the land of Israel. Now, in the land of Israel, we have gazelles and we have deer, two different animals. One is called a tzvi and one is called an ayal. In Europe, on the other hand, as well as in America, Europe's got lots and lots and lots of deer, but not a single gazelle. So when Jews went to Europe, they transferred the name Tzvi from the gazelle to the deer, because that's what they had. Right? That's why that transposition happened. And, you know, it's very funny because, like I say, in America, it's the same situation. You don't have gazelles. So many people in America, you know, are very confused about this and think that Tzvi is a deer. And you see that come up in like English translations. I think it was the Oswald Stone Chumash, where, you know, there's a phrase, Tzvi and Ayal, comes up many times in the Chumash. So Tzvi, they translate as a deer, but then they get up to the word Ayal, and you can kind of tell what's going through the translator's mind because he's stuck. He already used the word deer. All right. So they translate Ayal as a hind. But what's a hind? A hind is a doe, a deer, a female deer. It's just a female of the same thing. So, you know, Americans get confused because in America, just like in Europe, you've only got one animal. But here in Israel, you have two different animals, the tzvi and the ayal. Okay, so what do we know about the tzvi? So the tzvi is, of course, very, very fast. In fact, the most common glimpse of a tzvi, a wild gazelle, well, you see them in Israel, right? They're all over the country. I often sometimes see them on the way to the museum. I live in Ramat Beit Shemesh. Museum's about a 12-minute drive. And sometimes see them from the road. The most common glimpse of a gazelle is just, you know, the hindquarters of the gazelle running off, flashing off into the distance. Right? Someone just commented, so Levine, right, there's Gazelle Valley Park in Jerusalem. Right, Gazelle Valley Park, where they have a population of wild gazelles there. Someone's asking if it's an oryx. This isn't oryx. No, tzvi is not an oryx. Because it... One way to know what animals are is their prominence. You know, tzvi is mentioned in Tanakh so many times, it has to be a very common animal. And gazelles were very common throughout the country. Oryx were restricted to the desert. Okay. Now, so what this Mishnah that we mentioned earlier, right? The Mishnah says Gibor Kari. It says Azkanamer. It also says Ruatz Katzvi. Be as swift as a gazelle, right? So that's something very easy to understand. Just that the gazelle is an extremely swift animal. So too, the Mishnah says we should be swift to fulfill the will of God, right? When there's a mitzvah, you're onto it, right? You don't schlep, you don't take your time. You get to doing that mitzvah as quickly as you can. All right. And there's one more animal mentioned in the Mishnah, and that is the Nesher, the king of birds. What, you know, Al Kanfei Nesharim, right? God brought us out of Egypt, Al Kanfei Nesharim. So what is a Nesher? So let me just go back, hold on to the comments here. Sorry, just somebody wrote a comment here. How did the traditional Mefarshim explain the Ayal? I have to check that, but they were confused again. So Rashi, by the way, Rashi thought, they didn't know about gazelles. Rashi knew that Tzvi wasn't a deer, so he figured that maybe it's an ibex. That's what Rashi says, a steinbok, which is an ibex. But ibex is a different animal, it's the Yael. Basically, the Mefarshim living in Europe were stuck. Okay, Nesher. So Nesher, I see in the comments some people know the right answer.
Vulture.
What's the most common translation for Nesher? The most common translation for Nesher is the eagle. Eagle's wings, right? Now, the problem is that there are verses in Tanakh which describe the Nesher as being bald. Are eagles bald? No, they are not. Even the American bald eagle, lovely head of hair, which has as much hair as a bald eagle, just has white feathers on its head. In fact, originally it was called a baldy-headed eagle. Baldy, B-A-L-D-E, was an old English word meaning white. It was the white-headed eagle. Right. Over time, that name got shortened to be bald eagle. But they're not bald. And also, they don't live anywhere near here, so the Torah wouldn't be referring to them. All right. So what is the Nesher? It is the griffin vulture. Let's take a look at our griffin vultures. There we go. We have, those are our two griffin vultures above there. You can see them. They have very high ceilings here, so they're pretty high up. I'm not sure if you can tell the size of them, but they're enormous. Right? They've got a wingspan. Their wingspan can be up to, you know, 8 or 9 feet. Hold on, that light's in the way. There we go. So here are our griffin vultures. And the griffin vulture still lives in Israel, unfortunately much more rare than it used to be. Henry Tristram, who explored the land of Israel in the 19th century, said that wherever he walked around, he could always see vultures in the air. Now there's less than 200 left. There's a bunch of them in the desert down south. There used to be some in Gamla. Gamla in the Golan was a very famous place for looking at vultures, at griffin vultures. Unfortunately, they were poisoned. What happens is that there's farmers there who don't like their sheep being stolen by wolves and whatever, so they illegally leave out poisoned carcasses for the wolves. But the vultures end up eating the carcasses and die. And that's where actually these vultures came from. These were vultures that were poisoned in the Golan. So I don't think there's any left in Gamla. I believe there are still a few in the Carmel near Haifa. But most of Israel's surviving population is in the desert in the south. And the griffin vulture, you know, it deserves the title the king of birds, right? It's, you know, gigantic. Right? And it's also the lord of the air. It's the highest flying bird in the world. If you look in the Guinness Book of Records, you'll see that the altitude record for a bird is held by a griffin vulture, which collided with an airplane at 37,000 feet. Right, and they have special modifications to their lungs that enable them to, you know, to breathe at that altitude. And we'll see what they're doing at that. What are they doing so high? They're looking for other birds that are circling over carcasses. Right, the carcasses might be too far down to see, but what they can see is the other birds circling. And that's how they find their prey. There are efforts to try and rebuild the griffin vulture population in Israel. At the Jerusalem Zoo, they have breeding programs and so on. There's been a lot of effort put into it. It's a really uphill battle. And, you know, the vultures only lay one egg at a time, maybe sometimes two. It takes decades for them to reach sexual maturity. It's a real problem, and there's been so much effort put into it. I mean, there was an issue where they were getting electrocuted on cables, and then the electrical company redid the cables to insulate them. Tremendous amount of effort going in, but it's a really difficult struggle. And there could be one batch of poisoning, and they're all gone. Very sad, difficult situation. Anyway, so the first thing we have to mention about the Nesher is this. Since the Nesher, you know, is clearly the griffin vulture, right, plus in Tanakh, it's described as a bird that feeds on carrion, right, on dead animals. That's another way you know that it's a vulture and not an eagle. Eagles usually take live prey. By the way, I have to share with you the story of the griffin vulture who was getting too old to fly south for the winter. So we decided to go by plane. So we took some dead antelope as food for the journey. As he's checking at the airport with the check-in desk, they look at the dead antelope and they say, "Sir, are you planning on checking those in as luggage?" He says, "No, it's carry-on." No, but seriously, folks. So if the Nesher is the griffin vulture, so the question is, why is it always translated as eagle? And what's the answer? Who can tell me?
Cultural associations.
That's a secondary reason. What's the primary reason? Well, what was the reason why the Tzvi is translated as the deer? Right, Tzvi was translated as the deer because there were no gazelles in Europe.
There were no vultures.
Right? There were no vultures. So there are vultures in Europe, but only in Spain. Right, Spain has a lot of griffin vultures. And Ramban, who lived in Spain, you know, says that the Nesher is not the eagler, he says. It's the bald bird, right, the griffin vulture. But that was only in Spain, right? In Ashkenaz, where there was lots of Jewish activity taking place, in Ashkenaz there were no griffin vultures. It was the eagle that was the king of birds, right? And so that's how the transposition happened, same as with the Tzvi. Someone pointed out, so the highest flying bird in the world is the griffin vulture, native to the land of Israel, which has the lowest point in the world, right, the Dead Sea. Okay, so what does the Nesher symbolize? So we mentioned how it's the king of birds. There's a certain aspect of kingship. is actually, it's a tremendously compassionate parent. Now, Volt, as I mentioned, they usually only have one chick, and that chick takes a long time to reach adulthood. So they put a lot of care into their chicks. And that's the symbolism you see in the Nesher in, I think it's Vezos Hazinu or Vezos Abracha. I think it's Hazinu. Nesher, Ya'er al-Kino, al-Gozlov, Yerachef, right? It's talking about the tremendous, you know, compassion that the griffin vulture has for its young. And we hope that that's the compassion that God will have for us. Interesting. I want to mention at this point, somebody mentioned the, you know, the culture about the, why it was transposed was for cultural reasons. So, you know, many years ago, I was hired by ArtSquell to be a consultant on the Gemara, on Masechet Chulin, which deals with many animals, and they translated Nesher as eagle, and I told them it's a vulture. So I got the call from the editor, who was very upset. A vulture? God brings us out of Egypt in the wings of a vulture, that disgusting creature. And what I realized is that, what I realized is that, you know, animals have cultural significance, and it's interesting. In America, vultures have very, very negative cultural significance. Now, why is that? So I can think of two reasons. Number one is that the only vultures that you have in America are turkey vultures. Those are the birds you have down in Florida. Those are kind of disgusting, you know, not very impressive birds. You know, they're not like the gigantic griffin vultures that you have in Africa and other places. And the second thing, I think, is the Jungle Book, right? You know, Disney's Jungle Book, you know, which had vultures, you know, portrayed them as being, you know, oh, are they the bad guys, the idiots? I can't remember what it was exactly. It was certainly a negative portrayal. But in this part of the world, in the Middle East, right, it's the griffin vulture that's the king of birds, not just in Judaism, in other cultures too, in all the surrounding cultures, right? It's the griffin vulture that's the king of birds. It's the highest flying bird, you know, the most magnificent wingspan, the lord of the air, right? So it has that symbolism. And I came up with a proof. There were people who claimed, well, it can't be a vulture though, because it's, you know, how can there be any kingship, any of these ideas of royalty, these noble qualities associated with, you know, with a scavenger? And what occurred to me is that in America, it's fine, the turkey vultures are not very impressive, but there is a bird that is the equivalent to the griffin vulture in North America, and that is the condor, right? The condor, the California condor, right? It's bald, right? It's a carrion eater, and it has this huge wingspan. And how are California condors regarded in culture in the U.S.? They're not seen as something disgusting, right? They're seen as birds that are majestic, right, because of their size, because of their flight. So, you know, the condor is really, you know, the cultural equivalent to the griffin vulture. And actually, I'll say that we have a lot of groups visiting. We have a certain organization we work with that brings Bible teachers from all over the world, many, many, many different countries, and they want to know how to translate and teach the Bible. And you know, what I say to them is that when you're translating, it's not always so clear what you should use, because the animal that is the zoologically correct translation might not be the culturally correct translation. In other words, even though zoologically the Nesher is the griffin vulture, but if you want to really translate the bird in terms of its symbolic value, then maybe eagle or California condor is a better translation, right? There's no clear answer to this. It depends whether you're going for technical accuracy or for cultural symbolism. Okay. Now, but let's move on to a different aspect of the griffin vulture, and that is our Mishnah in Pirkei Avot that we've been referring to, right? The same Mishnah that says, be as strong as a lion and as swift as a gazelle and as brazen as a leopard, says that we should be kal kenesher, as light as a vulture. Now, what does that mean? So I've held live griffin vultures. They are not light. They are extremely, extremely heavy. Right, I did a video. Oh, actually, one second. This is what's going on over here. It's playing on the screen right here. Here we go. Here's me holding a griffin vulture. And, you know, the next day I could barely lift my arm. You know, it was so, so heavy. So if you're going to talk about being light as a bird, why would you pick the bird, which is one of the heaviest of all the birds? So the answer is that Kal Kenesher does not have to do with how much the bird weighs. It has to do with how much it flies. Now, griffin vultures, as I've mentioned, only live in hot countries. And they live in areas where it's very rocky. And what happens? You get hot thermals of air rising up over the rock. And these griffin vultures have this tremendously broad wingspan. And they perch on high places and cliffs. Therefore, what they do is they jump off, spread their wings, and they just soar up on their thermals. And that's how, you know, these tremendous altitudes that griffin vultures reach, They don't even have to flap their wings to get there. They're just, you know, majestically soaring up. So when the Mishnah says that we should be as light as a nesher to serve God, what it means is just as the vulture rises up, you know, effortlessly, you know, not sort of huffing and puffing and moaning and, you know, flapping its wings laboriously like other birds have to do. So too, that's how we should rise up to serve God, you know, with a spring in our step. You know, when we're going to help somebody, you know, there's no kvetching or moaning. No, sure, it's a pleasure, no problem. Right? That is air of ease. Hold on a second. The battery in my camera just died, so I'm just going to have to switch cameras to the... Hold on. One second, what just happened? Why isn't that camera not operating? Can you see me?
No.
No.
I'm just showing that the camera's... Oh, I see why. Hold on. All right, how about now?
Yes.
You can see me, but probably in less good quality than before. Okay. All right. So now we can understand what Kal Kanesher, you know, means. All right, rising up effortlessly, just like the griffin vulture with its tremendous wingspan and given the thermals where it lives, rises up effortlessly. So in order to understand what Kal Kanesher means, we have to know what a Nesher is, you know, and what a Nesher does. And that's the kind of thing which was so, you know, self-evident to people in antiquity, where there were griffin vultures circling overhead all the time, you know, but nowadays most people don't know what the bird is and certainly, you know, not sensitive to what the bird does. Okay. Now, so that's the Mishnah, which I have here on the wall. Now, the interesting thing about this Mishnah is that this Mishnah has been illustrated more than anything else in Judaism. Meaning that, you know, let's say you're decorating a shul, designing a shul, or you want to design do a front page for a sefer, for a Hebrew book, or the Aron HaKodesh, whatever it is, and you want to do a picture, you want to illustrate something from the Torah. So there's not many things from the Torah that are so great to illustrate. You know, how are you going to illustrate the Ten Commandments? You know? But this Mishnah is beautiful to illustrate, right? So for hundreds and hundreds of years, people were doing illustrations for this Mishnah. But let's look at what the illustrations are. Okay, I mean, some of them it's a bit difficult to make out. This is from an Aron HaKodesh now in Heichal Shlomo. But let's start off with this one. Hold on, this is a title page for a Vilna Talmud. Right, and it's got the animals of this Mishnah. So we've got the lion, right? But then down below, it's a deer, right? It's not a gazelle, it's a deer. As we said, people mistranslate things. And up here, it's not a griffin vulture, it's an eagle. And what about the namer? The namer is a tiger. All right, why is the namer a tiger? Let's look at another one up here. There we go, this picture. So once again, you know, the lion's correct. But the tzvi is a deer, not a gazelle. The nesher is a bald eagle, right, with a white head. Just make sure. Can you see it? Can everyone see it? Yeah. And again, the namer is a tiger. All right. Here's another one, a contemporary picture. Again, it's only the lion they get right. It's a bald eagle, a deer, and a tiger. All right. And this is, you know, all of them from so many different. Here's a Rosh Hashanah card. From the early 20th century, from the US, you got the US flag there. Again, a deer, a bald eagle. At least they got the leopard right on this one. Right? And so what are we seeing in all these pictures? What we're seeing is the result of Jews traveling to different places, being exiled around the world, and transposing whatever they're familiar with, the original animals. Right? So, you know, they didn't have any gazelles, so that became a deer. They didn't have any griffin vultures, so that became an eagle. They didn't have any leopards, so they knew it was some kind of exotic big cat, and the only kind of exotic big cat that was known in Europe was a tiger. So that's why that often became a tiger. And even in Ivrit, by the way, that's why many Israelis will say that Namer is a tiger, even though it's actually a leopard. And you know, I found something very interesting. Here's a kiddie's book. I just want to mention, by the way, that this exhibit here, our Perkei Avot exhibit, was dedicated by a friend, Dr. Stephen Weiss from Los Angeles, and he's collected, I think he has the world's largest library of commentaries on Perkei Avot. And, that's why he was able to, get me these, amazing pictures. We have many more of them too, you know, showing how it was illustrated. But then I also got this book. Yossi and Nussi's Trip to the Zoo. Okay, a Feldheim book. learning good middos from animals through Perkei Avot. Okay, so Yossi and Nussi go to the zoo here. There we go. They're looking at all the animals. And their father is telling them, look, we've got to learn from these animals, you know, their characteristics. You know, what can they teach us? So they start with a leopard. There we go. And Yossi and Nussi look up at the sign. And they, what do they learn? Not the largest wild cat, but leopards don't fear animals so big, even when they come near. Right. So he learned that from that, that we, to learn from a leopard, right, that he's small, but he's proud. He's fearless and bold. We too can be brave as we do what we're told. Okay. Very nice. So learning to be as brazen as a leopard. Then, one second, I'm just going to skip. We get to the tzvi, which of course, they have been speaking American, but they think is a deer. But okay, they learn from the deer to be fast, you know, to do what they need to do. So even though it's not the right animal, at least they're still getting, you know, the right message from it. And they have the lion also, right? Another strange illustration of the lion. They're talking about the power. Okay, it's talking about, and they talk about how we have to be strong internally with our middos, with our personalities. Okay, very nice. They got it right. But let's take a look at the nesher. So here they've got the eagle. Of course, they didn't know what a nesher was. So they go to look at the eagle. And we have here a lovely, you know, American bald eagle. And what do they say? They're learning about it. The eagles are good parents. What do we learn from that? That to be gentle. That the eagle is a gentle parent. And we learn from that that we need to be gentle. Kal kanesher. Now, kal does not mean gentle. It doesn't mean that. Kal means light. Right, you can see the people who made this book, they had just no idea how to translate that in terms of an eagle, because eagles are not light. They're very, very heavy birds. So they see again this great example about how, you know, in order to know what the Mishnah is telling us, you've got to know what the bird is and therefore what the bird does. But people, you know, in America, in Europe, you know, you're handicapped that way because you're getting the bird wrong to begin with. So how are you going to even know what the bird does? That's an interesting illustration of that. Now, used to be, I mean, this museum is 10 years old, 6 years in our old location, 4 years in our new location. This Perkei Avot became a big theme in the new location. And it used to be the angle, you know, that I trained the guides. I don't normally give the tours, but you have guides. And the angle I trained them with was this exhibit to show this idea about how, why were the identities of the animals lost? You know, because Jews moved to different parts of the world. Right? And it's showing the significance of how now, this is the big message here, that biblical natural history, you know, it's the history of the Jewish people, right? It's a consequence of the exile that we lost familiarity with all these animals, you know, of Tanakh, of the Torah. But now that we're back in our homeland, we can regain familiarity with these animals, right? You know, the people made mistakes as to what these animals are, but now we can get it right, right? Because now we're back in our homeland and we can really reconnect with these animals. That was the way we originally presented it. But over the last few months, especially since our October the 7th, I decided to, you know, modulate this and take it in a slightly different direction. Not in terms of what people got wrong, but in terms of what people were talking about. Because as we know, apart from the, you know, the horrific events that occurred in Israel on October 7th and following, but there's also simultaneously this worldwide, you know, outpouring of hatred against Israel, against Jews. And that's, and the way that's manifest, certainly when people are using academic or pseudo-academic terms, is to talk about colonial settlers. Right? That basically, we don't have any place in the land of Israel. We stole it. Right? We stole the land from the Palestinians. Right? The way it's coming out is it's not a discussion about the West Bank specifically or Gaza specifically. It's about the whole of Israel. Right, the whole of Israel is stolen. So if we stole it, if we're not from here, who are we? No, that we're Europeans, right? A bunch of Ashkenazim came from Europe and stole the land. Okay, so you know, there's a few things to be said to that. You know, one thing is that it's not like we're, you know, colonials were those who came to, you know, exploit the land and, you know, and take its riches in order to enrich themselves. We didn't come here to exploit it, to steal its riches. We came here because we needed to survive. Right? We needed somewhere to live. We were facing enormous persecution in Europe. No other country would let us in. A lot of the Jews who came here weren't even particularly Zionist. They came here just because they just needed, literally needed somewhere to live. All right? But that's, you know, certainly part of the answer. But another part of the answer is that we didn't just pick this random country because we happened to get into it. You know, we had this very, very deep connection with the land because it's the land of Israel, right? The land of the Jewish people. And that's something which people will either, you know, deny. There are many people in the Arab world who just deny the historic connection of the Jewish people with the land of Israel. Temple Mount denialism, right? That's the thing. There's other people who will acknowledge it or say, yes, it's true. You know, Jews lived here thousands of years ago. There was an ancient Jewish empire, but that was thousands of years ago. How's that relevant to today? You know, you left, you became Europeans. And that's where I think this comes in particularly significant. Because, yes, of course, you know, we can prove that we used to live here with archaeology. But in terms of the ongoing connection, you know, animals are a very fascinating part of this. You know, I want to show you something. Hold on, we can move the camera into a different room for this. Moving back into the auditorium. Okay, behind me. So let me see if I can get a better view here. Okay, this is a zoological cultural map of the world. All right, so this is a new exhibit we just set up. And what it's setting up is showing the idea about how different nations, you know, every nation has its own culture, right? And every culture has animals that play a role in that culture, right? And which animals play a role in the culture? Obviously, the animals that are from where that nation lives. So, you know, over in Australia, we've got a boomerang there. And it's got a picture of an animal on the boomerang. So what animal is pictured on the boomerang? Kangaroo, obviously, right? The coat of arms from Australia, a kangaroo and an emu. Moving up to Asia, so obviously the bear plays a prominent role in Russian symbolism, the tiger in Chinese symbolism. Saudi Arabia, it's the falcon. Right, Africa, right? So all our African art shows African animals. South America, got a woolly hat here. Anyone know what kind of wool this hat is made from?
Alpaca?
Alpaca wool, right. And there's a picture of an alpaca on it. Right. And then in North America, we've got the American bald eagle, the presidential eagle, Native American art with buffalo. Canada, we've got the maple leaf, right, and the beaver. The Canadians here can certainly relate to those, right? So what do we see? We're seeing how animals play a role, you know, in the cultures of different peoples. Now, so what were the animals that played a role in our culture? And it was the animals of Tanakh, or the animals of the Mishnah, such as this Mishnah we spoke about. So what I find amazing about this Mishnah is the focus now that we teach it, it's not that the people got the animals wrong. The focus is that even though they drew the pictures wrong, and even though they weren't exactly sure what these animals were, but they knew that in their culture there were these animals, that there was a lion, right, that there was a nesher, some kind of majestic bird, that there was some kind of very swift animal, some kind of ferocious big cat, right? That for thousands of years, they're drawing pictures of these animals, but they don't always get the pictures right. But they know that these animals are part of their culture. So I think this shows, you know, fascinatingly about how our link to the land of Israel, you know, always existed. You know, it's interesting, you know, there's many countries that have a national animal. And sometimes these are things that are not indigenous, but you'll find that with things like the lion, right? You know, the British coat of arms, the coat of arms for Britain is the lion and the unicorn, neither of which are actually indigenous to the British Isles. But, you know, they took on the lion because the lion is, you know, it's majestic. It's the king and, you know, rule Britannia. But in Judaism, the lion was significant, not just because it ruled, you know, because it's the king, but because it was so, because we lived with them. That's why it's mentioned 150 times in Tanakh, because people were being killed by lions and sometimes killing lions, and it was a part of life for us. It wasn't some abstract thing. Lions were very much a part of our lives. All right. So I think we know the significance of this mission in Perkei Avot now just shows, especially at a time when people are delegitimizing us as being, you know, European invaders to the land of Israel, showing no, our culture always included these animals, and these animals are from the land of Israel. Right, there were no lions in Europe, there were no gazelles in Europe, there were no griffin vultures in Ashkenaz, you know, there were no, gazelles, these animals didn't live there, no leopards, right? And there's something else I noticed. You'll have Jews who are called Aryeh, You'll have Jews who are called Dov. You have Jews that are called Zev, right? The wolf. But you don't have Jews that are called Namer. So why is that? So I think this custom, I think it was copied from non-Jews, and non-Jews would use animals that they were familiar with. There were lots of bears and wolves in Europe. Lions, everybody knew about because it's the king of beasts. But leopards, we knew about lepers in Europe. They didn't know about leopards. So I think that's why nobody became Namer, right? Or Nesher, right? People got the name Adler, and Eagle.
Binyamin was Ev.
Right.
It's very interesting. My father was Dovarie.
Right. So these are animals they knew about in Europe, right? But they did not know about leopards or griffin vultures. So I hope this has been interesting for you, you know, showing how these animals, the role they played and the way that they really, you know, point to our connection to the land of Israel. Any questions? I should mention also that a lot of these things I discuss, I have a book, the Torah Encyclopedia of the Animal Kingdom, which goes through all the references in the Bible, in Tanakh, in the Talmud, and the Midrash to wild animals, with a big mix of modern zoology also, and beautiful photos. Do not buy it from Amazon. Please do not buy it from Amazon. Instead, please buy it from the museum website, which I'm typing in here to the chat box, biblicalnaturalhistory.org. Is it not lit? Sorry, one second. You send it to everyone in meeting. There we go. Biblicalnaturalhistory.org. If you click on that and go to our shop, you can see the Torah Encyclopedia of the Animal Kingdom.
Yeah, it's very interesting when it's in the story of the bringing back the Jews from Yemenite. It's written Evet Yotrem al Kanfei Nesharim.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. It's very interesting why.
Right. And you do see, by the way, that Jews in other countries, non-Europe, were familiar with some of these animals, right? North African Jews, they knew what a tzvi was because they had a tzvi, right? So, yeah, some of these animals were familiar depending on which part of the world people lived in. Any other questions?
Thank you very much. Sharon Raphael Aumann, how are you?
Hi, we love coming. Hi.
Thank you very much.
We love coming to your museum, and we're sponsors, and everything you're doing is amazing. Thank you so much for a fabulous lecture, and we really, really enjoy everything that you do. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm so happy you're able to join. Yeah, there's many other animals in that Hall of Biblical Wildlife, but, you know, in the tour, we give tours, we just zip through the room. What I really love to do is speak about everything properly. So you see, when I speak about everything properly, it takes an hour just to get through four animals. And there's lots of other animals still in that room. So another time, maybe.
Thank you. Fantastic. Appreciate it. Kol tov. Nice to see you again.
Thank you. Wonderful lecture.
Rabbi, will you ever have an opportunity to talk about how Noah built the ark and was able to accommodate all kinds of animals, that the animals didn't eat each other? He knew what food to bring. Did they come from different places?
Okay.
You could probably do six lectures on that, too.
I don't get into the scientific aspects. I have a post on my blog which has a list of resources on that. What we do have at the museum is the world's most magnificent collection of models of Noah's ark from all over the world. Can you take a look at that? Here we go. Behind me is one of the display cabinets. Over 100 artistic representations of models of Noah's Ark. And, you know, probably towards Parashat Noah, I think we'll do a Zoom where I explain the significance of that exhibit. It's a new exhibit at the museum.
Hello.
It's very, very beautiful.
Good. Hi.
Rabbi's question to you. How did Noah knew about the Chayot HaTehorot? How did he know?
Very
good.
One second, Yaakov Yellen, could you mute your microphone?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I read your email very quickly.
You should be able to mute it.
Okay.
As
the host, you can mute everybody.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I just found that out. Yeah, I just realized that. Okay. So thank you very much. I hope you'll join me next week for the next class in this
Rabbi,
series.
Yeah? Rabbi, when you talked about a certain animal earlier in the lecture being going extinct about 900 years ago, I don't know if you remember, it was a leopard. So that wasn't, pardon, the lion. That wasn't under Jewish stewardship. It was. I don't remember who. So, what other, or were there other animals that went extinct at the under their stewardship? Which just
shows. Sure. So there were, you know, a lot of the animals in that hall became extinct at different times. So the hippo became extinct about 3,000 years ago. Lions, you know, they were hunted. They were used for the Colosseum and so on. So lions disappeared about 800 years ago. A lot of the other animals that disappeared.
But 800 years ago,
crocodiles, that was in the 19th or early 20th century.
So under the Ottomans.
Yeah, but then that was because guns were invented, and you know the Bedouin were very into hunting, and there were also the German Templars here, right? The German colony, that's after the German Templars, and they loved hunting. So that's why it was at the turn of the 20th.
But 900 years ago wasn't. 900 years ago wasn't animals for the Colosseum if it went extinct. It was for other reasons that it went extinct. But not lions.
Again, there was a lot of
Colosseum.
Deforestation here. And there was action, and people hunted lions wherever they could.
I have a question. For a technical note for the next lecture, please.
Yeah.
The depth of field, your camera is very sharp on you, but because you're so close to the camera, the depth of field of your camera is not sufficient to make what you show in the background sharp. So in particular, for example, the leopard was not a sharp image. And similarly, up on the ceiling, it's difficult to do.
I'll second that. So I think actually that's because this camera, I think I accidentally activated a mode that deliberately blurs the background. So I'll check into that for next time.
The background is not deliberately blurred. The background is just not sufficiently in focus because you don't have enough depth of field. I don't know what the quality of the camera is. Okay.
That's
I used to be a photographer, so I know about that.
I can tinker with that for next time.
Okay. I'm also a Yell at Packhouse's grandfather.
Ah, very nice. One of our treasured volunteers.
And Yehuda's, of course.
Wonderful, wonderful.
I have a question, please.
Yes.
Will this video or a transcript be available after?
I have no idea. Yes, ask Robbie Kelman about that.
The video is always available afterwards. The video, it takes maybe a day or two or three, I don't know. Right. But the video is always posted onto the Torah in Motion website, and it's possible to get access to it. And as you see, his wife has put out, yes, videos will be posted, etc.
Okay.
Do you have the link to the book, how to get the book? Again?
Yes, I'll type it again. It's biblicalnaturalhistory.org. Yeah, I'm typing it in again to the chat box. Oops. Biblicalnaturalhistory.org. One second. Org. Oh, hold on. Send to everyone meeting. Okay.
Oh, there it is. Thank you.
That will take you to the museum website, and you go to our shop, and that's where you can get the book. And we also have a mailing list on the website, on the museum website. You can sign up for there also.
Many thanks.
And you can always just search on the internet for Biblical Museum of Natural History. Okay, so I'm going to sign out here. I'm happy that you could all join me. Look behind me, there's a leopard skin. See that? Although actually, when we test kids and visitors, we say, what's that skin? And more than one occasion, kid says, flying squirrel. But no, it is a leopard. All right, I'm going to say goodbye, and I look forward to seeing you next week.
Thank you.